Look at the stress we put on ourselves. We put imaginary stresses on ourselves. We worry about the future. We worry about stuff we have absolutely no control over. Things that are chaotic in our lives have such a strong impact. And there is a reason, my dears, why I am offering this to you today. Again, when I have something that's going on in my life, and it's so overwhelmingly obvious, okay? You know what I'm saying? One of those times in your life where it's like everywhere you look, right? Every single person that I know is going through some type of major chaos right now, and it's a breakdown. It's a destruction of the old, but you can't just destroy the old and just be left flat. This documentary, I am so happy to be offering it to you as a thank you gift. We're sending you this as a gift for your contribution to this radio station. Again, folks, I'm telling you, it take me out of the equation completely. I may not be here next drive, okay? I may not be here next year. This radio station must. It's not about the personalities of this station. It's not about your favorite hosts, although you love them, although I love them. It's about the radio station being able to stay on the air and your contribution during this hour on something that means so much to so many people is sending a message to management, but it's also sending a message out into the world that you believe that you have some control in your life. And as you're going to find out from these interviews that are in this documentary called Emotion, these are Western medicine doctors, quantum physics experts, kinesiology experts, biology, genetics experts. In this incredible documentary, you're going to find out what the underlying causes are for everything that makes us sick and what you can do about it. And if you can call up and pledge just $100, we'll send this to you as a thank you gift. It's called eMotion, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. But I'm going to ask for those of you who can't, I need 20 people in the next few minutes. I need 20 people to call up and get the Lose What Needs to Be Lost pack. This is a $150 pledge, so it's only $50 more. It's $12.50 a month if you spread it out over an entire year. The $150 for something that you would have to normally pledge $200 for, you're going to get two very powerful, important DVDs that you're going to want to share with others. You're going to want to keep and watch over and over again. Number one is the Emotion DVD that we're playing clips from, brand new. The other one is something that helped me so very much lose. Again, I lost such an incredible amount of weight, and I did it in a very healthy manner, and great part of that reason why I was able to do that was from this DVD that I want to share with you and get to you as well. It's called 7 pounds in 7 days. You can get this by itself for a $100 contribution. You can get Emotion by itself for a $100 contribution, or get them together in the Lose What Needs to Be Lost pack for a $150 pledge, or $12.50 a month. 7 pounds in 7 days is there's the Juice Master Jason Vale. He actually walks you through how to detoxify, lose weight, improve your vitality in an amazingly delicious way. There's juice and smoothie recipes and all that good stuff. There's a handy-dandy wall planner guide in here as well, and you are going to be amazed at how you feel. How, you know, putting live foods in your body is so vitally important. And when you feel better, then you take a look at the world a little bit differently. The challenges that you're hit with, you know, everybody has challenges. Everybody has ups and downs. But when you're hit with something and your body is thriving and you're working off of live cells, live delicious organic juice, plus you're losing weight, you will take a different tact sometimes. You will see. And the beautiful thing about both of these DVDs, that it's included in the Lose What Needs to Be Lost pack, both of these DVDs talk about the importance of not only what you put in your mouth, but what you put in your mind. What thoughts? Think about that. What thoughts are going through your head on a daily basis? When you first wake up in the morning, what's the first thought that comes to your head? Is it a worry? Is it a concern? Or is it a wish for something wonderful to happen? What's the first thing that comes through your head when you wake up in the morning? I really want you to think about that. Most people don't even think about that. They wake up, they go, oh, I just woke up. I don't know. No, you're thinking. You're thinking constantly, right? And what are your thoughts throughout the day, even if you go into a chaotic environment? This radio station is, it's been chaos. It's always been chaos. Why? Because it is such a magnificent ability. It has such a magnificent ability to reach so many people. So everyone wants to have a voice. Everyone wants to have their perspective or their point of view out into the world so that they can say, hey, you know, this is how I feel. Do you feel the same way? That's called connection. We want connection. We want love. When you all go down to it, we want love and acceptance. This pack, lose what needs to be lost. This pack for a $150 pledge, I promise you, you're going to get so much out of it. And this is, like I said, I'm so very, very happy to be offering this to you. You get the 7 pounds in 7 days DVD in that pack, plus Emotion. Lose what needs to be lost. The pack, a $150 pledge, not $200 as you normally would have to do if you got them both. But $150, call right now. Please, folks, I need at least 15 more callers. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. And if you're someone who's listening and you have the ability, because I'd like to raise $3,000 this hour, if you have the ability to pledge $3,000 to cut us a check, to put it on your MasterCard, your Visa, American Express, call up right now. Say, tell Christine to just not even bother putting out the phone number. I'm going to give you $3,000 and tell her to play as much content as she can. Oh, I will do it. I will be your servant. I shall. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. $100 pledge gets you Emotion by itself. $100 pledge also gets you 7 pounds in 7 days. The incredible juicing DVD that will blow your mind. If you get them together in the lost, what needs to be lost, found, the lose, what needs to be lost, found, excuse me, it's a $150 pledge, not $200, and we need calls right now. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We talked a lot about in emotions, living in a world with chaos and everything that's happening to you. I want you to listen to this next clip, because I think that this is something, again, when it hits with me in my heart and it resonates with me, I know that you're feeling it. And I know that your neighbor's feeling it. And I know that your loved ones are feeling it. And maybe somebody that you really, really care about is going through some really rough time right now. You owe this to them. Get this DVD. Share it with them. Sit down and watch it. It's beautifully made. This clip is going to talk about living in an emergency mode. I want you to listen to this. If it resonates with you at all, if you think that this is you, because it is, it's everybody, please call right now and pledge your support. $100 gets you Emotion by itself, or $150 gets you the Lose What Needs to Be Lost pack, 2 DVDs in all. It's just $12.50 a month. The number, one more time, 818-985-5735.
If we look at living in an emergency mode all the time, the emotions that are derived from those chemicals of stress are the emotions of anger, of aggression, of hatred, of prejudice, of fear, of anxiety, of insecurity, of hopelessness, of powerlessness, of depression. Those long-term effects of those chemicals are the emotions that most people call normal states of consciousness.
In the ancient world, they knew that negative emotions store all through the anatomy of the body, and it affects the emotional physiology or function of the anatomy.
Your body is your unconscious mind. It doesn't know the difference between an experience in your life that creates an emotional response and an emotion that we fabricate by thought alone. To the body, it's believing it's in the same environmental conditions. So, it's a scientific fact that the chemicals of stress dysregulate and downregulate our genes that create disease. It's a fact. So, if we can turn on a stress response just by thought alone, and those chemicals can make us sick, then by very definition, our thoughts can make us sick.
They believed anciently that the emotions were actually generated by the organs in our bodies, and I believe that that's absolutely true. When we're feeling an emotion of anger, for example, that emotion is actually being created. That frequency is generated by the liver in most cases. Think about people who drink. Oftentimes, they overstimulate the liver and they become angry. On the other hand, the lungs produce the emotion of grief, among others. And so people who tend to have a lot of grief in their lives tend to suffer from lung issues.
I want you to understand why different cultures knew. If you have a pain in your thumb, that's very significant in a very significant emotion. If you have a pain in your elbow, your shoulder, If you feel a little pain in your chest, in your hips, in your stomach, in your intestines, a lot of people don't understand anymore the connection of the entire body to the brain, and the brain seeing pictures that create emotions which create behaviors.
Because emotions are a record of the past. And so if the emotion is stored in the body, then the body literally is living in the past. And the body is the unconscious mind, believes it's in the same environmental conditions 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. The body's literally living in the past.
Emotions tend to build up, and we tend to push them away as they build up because we've been taught to resist things that don't feel good instead of feel the things that don't feel good. And we look for answers, and the problem is that the answers aren't out in our world. They're inside us because the feelings are from inside us.
When I look at the mathematics I've written and the concepts that these mathematics bring, it shows that within every proton, every subatomic particle in the nuclei of atoms is all the energy, all the information of all other atoms in the universe. So when we go inwards is when we actually connect with that oneness, with that connectivity of all things.
We've got a physical body, and we've got an energetic body. And that energetic body is known as the chakra system, and there's seven of them. And so our beliefs, the energy of our beliefs, is stored in the light body of our chakras. And depending upon which chakra is involved, influences how we then perceive ourselves and the world around us.
And we call these trapped emotions patterns, but we do experience them that way. If it's an experience that we have not completed and come back to self, we do find a way to keep repeating those experiences. And so we re-traumatize ourselves.
This is Ward Churchill saying, get yourself a mind transplant. Listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM.
Free Radio Santa Cruz is losing its studio location, and so we reach out to you with $500 in hand. A reward for 1 year location. We can pay some rent. We do need a bathroom facility, some small square footage, electricity. Contact us if you know a location that can help. FRSC@freakradio.org.
Hey there, folks. It's Bathroom Spears Broadsides yet again, 6 to 8, Civil Rights for the Poor here on the Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We're going to try to grab one of the guests, hosts, or possibly something in between. I'm not sure. This man in the studio is also involved with Art and Revolution, and I understand they're scheming to put some big, heavy puppet cops on the street to deal with these crazy, sleeping, homeless people. So stay tuned for more of that on Bathroom Spears Broadsides for the next 2 hours here on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
The king and I and the catcher in the rye, Eisenhower vaccine, England's got a new queen, Marciano Liberace, Santiago. Of Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc, Roy Cohn, one for all, Tuscanini, Dacron, Gin Gin, Foo Balls, Rock Around the Clock, Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn Down, a winning team, Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bardo, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Princess Grace, Katie Grace, Trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire, and there's always murder since the world. We're
Don't. Yes, we do. Good. Hey there. You are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and this is 96.3 FM, and I am Robert Norris, and this is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. And we have Shanghai'd, one of the people running the last show, who we're going to attempt to engage in conversations. This man actually has a secret identity he has not yet revealed to his radio audience. He is, in fact, not only a police officer, he is a big police officer. Officer, I understand that you... How tall are you?
Geez, how tall am I?
I understand, if I'm not mistaken, that you are one of these large, 12-foot-tall, somewhat cardboardish-type officers that can be found in the Art and Revolution group that's going to be doing some active, well, some would call them skits or drama, but I would say they're simply a representation of real life down on the, I guess you'll be in front of the town clock from 9 to 12 on, what is it, February 19th?
Well, there's a few things that are going on here. There's going to be this coming Monday, there's going to be a demonstration going on at 11, and then the following Saturday as well, I believe that's the 20th, a week from this Saturday, there'll be a demonstration. These are all starting around, like, in front of the post office, and there'll be little, like, kind of interactive theater things.
A demonstration? What's this about, anyway?
Well, we're going to be, you know, the whole camping ban thing. We're going to put it to the streets, to the people, and I'm going to be actually one of the...
Camping ban, aren't you talking about the laws that protect our community from these messy, poo-poo-ish type campers who are mobbing the entire city and overrunning it with litter and feces?
I'll be there to enforce the Santa Cruz City Ordinance section, you know.
6.36.010, perhaps?
That's the one.
Well, I'm glad that somebody is on the ball. You know, I know that the task force to examine the camping ordinance, which I just came from, incidentally, from 4 to 5, had been doing a merry job blathering away about how they're not going to change the law. And here you are, reassuring us, as perhaps you should be, that the law is going to go on as usual. We are going to have safety and order in our streets and in our bushes.
Well, you haven't heard the latest news, I hear. You must not have heard the latest news, because if you were watching our theater performance, you would see actually that they did decide to make changes. Well, I mean, according to, of course, the theatrical representation, and art is life, and et cetera, et cetera.
So there are some changes, officer? Spell it out. I mean, you are the police. You run the show. So therefore, give us the story. Or as Judge Mulligan says in his court, tell us the facts, officer.
Well, we'll be passing out tickets, of course, for people to appear at our performances next Monday, and then also the following Saturday. And, of course, at the city council meeting on the 23rd, when it looks like this is going to be talked about. You have any more on the situation on when, if it's going to be talked about? Or
I definitely do. I came from Catherine Byers' traveling dog and pony show, or the task force to examine the camping ordinance, or should I say to ratify the camping ordinance and to ignore the sleeping ban, which of course is the aspect of the camping orders, as some of us had hoped, you know, beyond hope, would be dealt with in some way by this new liberal city council. But on the 23rd, indeed, as you point out, is a city council meeting. And that council meeting will be happening at 3:30, probably, maybe at 3, they're sometimes early. And at 7, that's the key meeting. 7 o'clock considers ordinance changes. And there's usually a period of half an hour when one does, or can do, if Mayor Byers is gracious enough to allow it, public comment. And that's a period of 3 minutes when, if you haven't spoken the week before, and if it's not on the agenda, and if they don't decide to put 2 hours of other items in front of it, as they did last week, I should say 2 weeks ago, then you will be allowed your opportunity to speak for 3 minutes. Unless, of course, Councilmember Rotkin interrupts you with some comments or points of order, which actually hasn't happened much. But then there is going to be an item about the camping ordinance. Now, rumor has it, we don't know this is true, but the rumor has the task force is actually going to present some new language in the camping ordinance. Nothing so radical as making it okay for a homeless person to sleep at night. We wouldn't want to go that far. No, but I'll tell you some of the changes in just a moment. But why don't you first tell me what kind of things, officer, you're going to do to make sure that order is maintained in our city?
Well, me armed with my toy... everybody, I hope everybody out there knows this is going to be a toy water pistol.
Well, you know, James, Happy John Dine was armed apparently with a toy gun, and he certainly got his comeuppance, didn't he?
Well, I'm going to be armed with a neon water pistol with my cohort cop, and we're going to be doing a little dance, and we'll actually be enforcing the new camp that will be open. Of course, this camp, fellow
buyers, perhaps.
Well, this particular summer camp, year-round camp, we might have to actually do without the total will of the
community. You know, Christopher Krohn has told us that one of these months, somewhere down the road, we can get a community consensus. He assures us that something is going to be done.
Well, something just might be done, and we'll just have to see what that's going to be, I guess.
Before that community consensus happens, you say you're going to establish a camp, and this is going to happen on what date?
Yet to be determined, but just be ready with the camping gear, and we'll see if we can probably maybe a vacant lot people know, or we can just set up a camp.
Weenie roasts for the homeless, is this the idea? I mean, we know these homeless people could get a job if they wanted. They are homeless by choice. They wander the streets, bothering the natives, distressing the horses, and generally causing consternation. Now, are you going to attempt to dramatize the need to purge ourselves of this group of lowlifes?
No, made the conversion, I have to say. Of course, as a police officer, I'm only enforcing the law laid out to me by our city council, of course.
Now, wait a minute. This ticket here says, citation, all ye curb sitters, loiterers, insufficient consumers, and scofflaws are hereby given notice to appear 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, February 6th, between the main post office and Espresso Royale, to witness a theatrical depiction of illegal activity, camping, and or sleeping without a permit. We now have a phone call without a permit. Hang on for just a second.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
There are no more empty lots in Santa Cruz.
Well, I thought there were lots of lots.
No. Uh-uh. That's going to be a problem because they're starting to build all these things.
So are you suggesting that this is in reference to what caller?
He was talking about putting a camp up.
I see.
And the point I'm getting is that they're putting in more and more buildings downtown. So we can't have these campers here because it would be...
There ain't no room. Why don't they go to Fresno? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Well, there's this nice...
Salinas has good housing.
There's this really beautiful, nice two-story building across...
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM... It's Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, the March 3rd, 2016 edition. This one's going to be a stranger show than usual, if I get it done in time, so stay tuned.
They simply make me mad. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of bread lines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Press your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. Song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social will. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
And welcome to this edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. It is March 3rd. We are still not live, although this is recent. I'll be playing this several hours after I record it on March 3rd. Some interesting things are in the works. The proposed city council meeting on the 8th, also the date of the 35th Freedom Sleepout, which we've been doing, or I should say Toby Nixon and a loyal coterie and contingent of Freedom Sleepers has been doing every week, every Tuesday night. There's also going to be reportedly a sleeping ban amendment to the camping ordinance that will strike the word sleeping from the camping law, something that HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, has long advocated. There was a meeting today that a bunch of us activists had with Micah Posner, council member, currently under fire, as many of you know, for helping out a friend with low-income housing by essentially creating a sort of a makeshift bedroom in his backyard, which, frankly, I don't know, the more housing, the better, as far as I'm concerned, and I see a lot of the attacks on him as political. I'm still having trouble with Councilmember Posner getting him to get records from the police department as to what the sleeping ban citation situation is, which he insists he will do but hasn't done. Similarly, he kind of begs off when I've asked him to get the records of what's been happening with complaints by tenants about conditions in housing, because I've been concerned for years. I was when the law was initially created, the new tenant inspection law, that it really wasn't concerned with the rights of tenants. It had to do with creating a new city bureaucracy and new city positions and new city powers over landlords that weren't really exercised in the interests of the tenants. And in order to kind of more closely track this, I've asked council members at different times. Rotkin, I think, was the first that I raised this issue with, though I don't recall if I made this specific request to him at the time. I certainly talked about it on free radio. There apparently is a backlog of complaints regarding tenants and ADUs, accessory dwelling units, and perhaps just backlog of complaints regarding tenants and landlords generally that isn't being addressed by the city. And I wanted to find out just how deep this backlog is, how long it is, to what extent it's been reduced over the last 5 years because of the tenant inspection law, which has provided more money to the city and more inspection power. And so far, I have not been able to get the city to provide me with that kind of information. Admittedly, I'm trying to kind of cover a whole bunch of issues ranging from police use of force, police acquiring of military equipment, racial profiling in the police department, use of chokeholds, tasering, and other forms of potentially lethal control or punishment by police. Anyway, we had a meeting today about the issues around this sleeping ban reform that are coming up. And frankly, the positive thing about this meeting is it brought together a bunch of older, I would even say old-time activists, who a couple of decades ago were working on this issue, actually under the direct aegis of the city council, which created two bodies. One was the task force to examine the camping ordinance, which was itself a three council member group that was looking over the entire camping ordinance and subpoenaing, or I should say subpoenaing, inviting and numerous groups to come and talk to it. And then a year later, the Homeless Issues Task Force, headed by Chair Linda LeMaster, actually Don Lane, the current council member, was, I guess, the secretary. And activist Laura Tucker was the assistant secretary. I wanted her to be the direct secretary. I wanted homeless people to take those positions. But Lane, as I saw it, inveigled his way into that position and got, what, quadruple the play, the pay that Tucker got. Which I raised today at the, I should raise at this meeting with Micah, just sort of to clarify exactly some of the history that Lane has on homeless issues, where he has been a supposed champion and yet repeatedly voting for anti-homeless laws over his last 8 years, and not speaking out about them when he was out of city council. He was a city council member from 1988 to 1992, at which point during one of those years he was also mayor. Anyway, the issue that's coming up is the sleeping ban reform law, which I'm going to have more on Sunday. And I will be talking about that more extensively, and perhaps about the debate in the activist community. We were again sidelined and kept out of the official meeting with Don Lane, for which I was quite upset, although it was quite anticipated as well. Not just I was kept out, but other activists who have done, as I said, a lot of work on this issue, particularly examining the legal implications of the wording of the ordinance and trying to change it in a positive way that would still allow for some regulation of camping, but would still remove the criminalization of homeless people and the blank check that police currently have. So I'm going to be talking about that in more detail in the next show. And what I'm going to do now is play a couple of hours from the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon, which I think can soon, if it's not already, be accessed online. And usually I try to avoid giving you a repetition of something online. But frankly, I've run out of time to catch up with today's show, and so I'm going to have to do this. It also is opportune in another way. Much of the Homelessness Marathon, the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon this year, was played towards the end of February, but because of some power outages and also because of some screw-ups by programmers at the Free Radio Santa Cruz center, and that's not a studio. We still don't have a studio, and you still can make $500 if you can find us a 10 by 10 space with access to internet and access to electricity. Call 423-4833. That's my number and the number of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I'll pass on any information you have. And if that leads to a studio space for us, and it could even be a space in a backyard, which, by the way, ironically, I think that if Micah Posner had rented out that space to Free Radio, it would not have been illegal because we would not have been residing there. It would have been simply a studio area that we were using. In any case, because we don't have a studio and because there were some screw-ups, and it happens occasionally, the first 3 or 4 hours of the Homelessness Marathon were not broadcast directly on Free Radio, though, as I said, they can probably be found online. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to broadcast them, and you're going to be able to hear Jeremy Alderson's 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon, the first couple of hours, and a lot of interesting stuff, again, stuff you can find probably if you sought it out yourself, but I think you'll find it worth listening to. I was trying to locate Toby Nixon's segment. Toby, Troubleshooter Toby, Toby, as I've called him, has been the mainstay for the Freedom Sleepers for the last month or two. And he was slated to go on the Homelessness Marathon, I think 7 hours into the marathon, which began at 4 o'clock our time and then lasted all the way until 6 in the morning the next day. but I don't know that he actually did. I've run through the marathon hour that he was supposed to be on. I can't find him. But hopefully I will have an interview with him, or at least some updates on what his plans are for next Tuesday, as well as a report from Pushback Pat Colby on how things went this last Tuesday. Apparently more people were sleeping on the sidewalk and successfully raising the issue that other folks elsewhere in the city are getting citations for what is essentially, what is a life-sustaining and essential activity, sleeping at night. But let's hear now from the Homelessness Marathon, first probably hour and three quarters or thereabouts, and I'll be back with you on Sunday, hopefully with more original material and more local material from Santa Cruz, which is what I like to present, and I think we need to hear.
Welcome to the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free number for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody, followed by the number 8. If you are homeless, formerly homeless, or about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT.
And actually, those numbers will not work, because this is a rebroadcast of something that happened a week or two ago. So enjoy it anyway.
This land is your land. This land is mine.
We'll talk with Doug Seegers from Nashville, who is unknown here, but famous abroad for one of the most amazing stories ever about good fortune getting someone out of homelessness. We'll be reaching him on tour in Sweden. And we'll talk with developer Sean Connolly, who says he was run out of Hollywood, Florida, for the crime of giving homeless people cheap places to live. Their voices and more right after this.
Poetry is the expression of the soul, and homeless souls are no different than ours. These poems are the expressions of their life experiences.
Heather Blanchard, mental health. What I know and what I hope for are two different things. The knowing is what makes me crazy. You ask so much of me and offer so little in return. You tell me to trust you and trust the system, that maybe it won't be like last time. You ask me to give my all for vague promise. You're the one that's crazy. The leper, their eyes say I am an imposter in their clean, orderly world. Who am I to try to fit in with my funky hair and torn-up jeans and my unwanted point of view? They nod to each other and smirk. Their know-it-all smiles say that there is something inherently wrong with me, an inner leprosy that I will never be. The sound of water. The rain plops into my coffee and puts out my cigarette. I drop it in the gutter with the others, and they crowd each other like boats on a river. My wool coat gets heavy and weighs me down. My spirit would like to float above these clouds, but there is nowhere to go. So like water, it flows downhill into the sewer with the spent cigarettes. The Homeless Woman's Prayer by Storm. The homeless women. We are the mothers. We are the sisters. We need opened eyes, help to stay from the arms of harm's clutches. You are the mothers. You are the grandmothers. And we are left to cry for help, for what you have that we have not. Thank God you are safe. We have to live on the streets. Scared to death is the fact and the key word. You have a locked door, we do not. You have showers, we have few. You can keep the bugs from your hair. We are infected with little choice. We are your wives, we are your sisters, We are your mothers. We dodge guns, we dodge knives, and sometimes we dodge rape. God, give us hygiene. Please, God, help us stay clean. And if you have the time, keep us safe. We do not want to live in crime-filled streets. God, please, get us out.
Homeless, author unknown. Under a metal awning, over a deck in North Baltimore, a house sparrow feeds chicks a wriggly worm. Following age-old instinct, father prances on the rail. Chirrup, chirrup, chirrup. In a locked building above a desert north of San Diego, a hand puppet feeds a box-hatched chick a wad of processed horse. Following its human manipulator, father squats on concrete slab. Vulture soaring beyond bar stockade, one the successful fruit of unthinking nurture by millennia of mothers. Surely they bred wild, if rare, in Europe's woods before humans changed the world to sparrowland. The other an effort by scientists, ornithologists, ecologists, embryologists, ethologists, neonatal metabolism gastroenterologists. Once condors bred wild, if rare, on California cliffs before humans changed the world to sparrowland. One familiar and sightly pest, take a broomstick to the nest. The other few have ever seen, downcast men will work for food signs, pay for research that might extend Pleistocene scavenging a few decades. Who counts in our world? Who decides whose is quality of life? Does God cut the checks in Washington? Or sit on the deck in Baltimore proclaiming, chirrup, 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 to his creation?
To the 18th annual homelessness broadcast, national broadcast. We've heard from all across the country this evening and morning, and we are about to hear internationally, hopefully from Sweden, and once homeless street musician Doug Seegers, who in a odd twist of luck was discovered in Nashville by two Swedish musicians happening to be there and ended up recording with them, and his life has changed drastically. So hopefully we'll hear from him about his time being homeless, as well as how his music has now changed and impacted his life. We'll also talk to in this hour Sean Canoni, who refers to himself as a homeless advocate and a humanitarian. And he was basically incentivized to leave Hollywood, Florida, where he lives and where he works, to eradicate homelessness. So we want to hear from him. And finally, we'll also talk to Ray, a homeless man from Denver Homeless Out Loud. We talked to another member of Denver Homeless Out Loud earlier. But as we know, Denver Homeless Out Loud is the successor to Resurrection Village. My name is Katia Stitt, and again, WPFW FM is the host, station for this year's Homelessness Marathon. And Otis McClay is with us, one of the chief architects, along with Jeremy Alderson, the mastermind.
Not an architect. It is Jeremy.
It is Jeremy. He is the mastermind.
Hanger on.
Well, a technical one, though. We're very happy to have you there. And so, Otis, give us, if we could, while we're waiting for our guests to come on the line, and I think we have someone there in just a moment, talk to us about how this originated. We haven't heard yet how the homelessness broadcast came about.
Jeremy has always had this interest in homelessness, you know, and actually very much in social justice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was very much involved in the anti-fracking work in upstate New York,
right,
where he lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, he just started this thing on a shoestring and kind of put people together and try to get a little bit of funding. And every year we'd do it in a different city. And I that's why when you were calling it the homeless marathon, I thought that was really appropriate. That's why we do it in a different city every year. You know?
Well, we'll attribute that to your tiredness, but
yeah, and in many ways it's kind of parallel to homelessness because it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have a place.
Right.
I mean, it's really interesting. The other thing he does is we always do it in the winter,
mm-hmm.
and we build this little shed. You saw it. And
I love that setup, by the way.
And he sits out there.
Right there in the street.
In the cold.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found tonight, what I learned tonight, because we also, very often we put the control inside a room, but it, because of the logistics here, we had it outside, and I really experienced this, you know, cold. Yeah, it's okay, I'm cold. But then I got very clearly the idea that when you're homeless, there's no relief.
Right.
You're cold.
Right.
There's no place to go to
warm up. And it gets in your bones.
There's no fire burning.
And it stays there.
You know,
yes.
And you can't even have a beer.
Right.
Barely coffee, maybe. I mean, it's absolutely amazing to me that this richest country in the world
mm-hmm.
cannot deal with this problem.
And, you know, so that is talking about the adults. I mean, we encountered adults tonight. But think about families.
The kids.
The children.
Which we always forget.
Right.
You know, they go home with some old guy or something like that. You have a lady carrying bags. It's kids.
Right.
These are little kids. There was a little Ebony was there tonight.
Mm.
Absolutely charming little girl. I mean, this is crazy.
Right.
This is our future. I mean, it's insane.
And what does a child grow up thinking about themselves when a society turns its back on them?
Yeah.
You know, they internalize that feeling of, I must not be worthy.
You know, I don't know if kids think that, but I think there comes a moment when they discover it, and it's almost more a sharper discovery than it would be if they just kind of gradually grew up. You know, kids accept what's there.
Right.
But then there's a point at which you realize what this insane society has done.
Right.
One of the things that I notice is a many, many times to the majority of the people who call on the phone or the guests we have are extremely articulate
mm-hmm.
and have a very clear picture of what this is all about
mm-hmm.
and the
mm-hmm.
source and everything.
Well, let me remind folks that they are in tune to the 18th Annual Homelessness Broadcast, and we'd love for you to join the conversation. Many of you, if you're on the East Coast, you're just waking up, and maybe if you're on the West Coast, you might be just going to bed. But wherever you are, or maybe not at all, maybe you are out there in the street and you want to share your experience of homelessness, the number to call here, 202-588-0893. The number to call again to join our conversation, 202-588-0893. And, you know, Otis, I have to say again and again, we talk to many of, at least in this area, but I think across the country, we talk to providers. And again, you find these pockets of community where they have joined with the it's not an us or them or us and them situation. They have actually joined with those the population of folk that they are trying to help and said, okay, how are we going to solve this together? And it is encouraging to see that, because sometimes you feel, I know I do, that tackling a problem such as homelessness, you really kind of, you know, the folks affected by it are in a vacuum, and then they're outside of that, there are all these folks working on it, but the two aren't meeting. But what we've illuminated tonight is, in fact, no, that's not true. There is this great tapestry of folks who are affected also being the source of the solution. You know, one very poignant example, and a beautiful example, is the tiny house movement.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And one of the issues that we were in Sarasota last year,
mm-hmm.
And one of the issues that came up there was the difference between a rescue mission here where you can spend a night and housing. And housing was really the issue. And that tiny house thing was going on right there. Somebody actually built one, I think.
In Sarasota.
Whole thing. Well,
mm-hmm.
some woman, a woman had given land.
Right.
And then the city refused to allow that land to be used to house homeless. I mean, you know, you have to wonder if this is what is intended by many people in government. it that we actually want to force people not to have a life because it's so consistent across the country. There are a few places, I think, that have worked on it. I can't name them now. Jeremy mm-hmm. could. But for the most part, it's pretty dire. And it,
well, and the intention is, I think, you know, when we talk about, I think there's a caller, when we talk about the issue of homelessness and how the government responds, it really, and Stuart illuminated this, it has to do with materialism, it has to do with gentrification, it has to do with not wanting to see those things that we can't fix, or we think we can. We can really fix it. The people do have the power. We can fix it, but we think we can't. And because it's something that we also feel doesn't need to touch us, we want to just shutter it away. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do that is just to move people, warehouse people in prisons, or move them out, you know, literally bus them. We heard folks, I think you interviewed a gentleman, where they were offering bus tickets out of the state.
But if you leave Boise, we would...
Yeah, you imagine that. We won't pay for any kind of housing for you, but we'll pay your bus fare to somewhere else. I mean, this is madness. And
I think you have to look at it from, you know, who benefits and what's the benefit.
Well, exactly.
I am much more cynical, frankly.
Exactly.
You know, because the solution is relatively obvious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Many of the homeless would be perfectly happy to have a tiny house.
Right.
Place where they could live that they could count on being there. We got that? No, okay. There are some people who are homeless who probably need more support than that, than just living alone. I mean, but it's a pretty obvious solution. You know, we build little houses. We realize that many of these people are people who were middle class until a year ago because of some unforeseen event. You know, the death of a spouse, any number of possibilities. And yet, those obvious solutions are rejected.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like, oh, well, this would clean it up. We wouldn't have the tourist problem with people seeing all these people littered around. So why do they not choose that solution? I mean, I can think of a couple of things. One is, can't give them nothing for nothing. Just the idea that you can't give them something because we're giving so much to Wall Street right now.
Right.
There's not enough left over.
Well, you know, exactly.
No, I'm being funny, but I mean
well,
seriously.
Well, but there is some seriousness
that
in that.
That concept of ours that we can't give it right. away. We have
but
to
in fact,
really
we are giving it away.
Well,
we're just not giving it to the people who need it.
Yeah.
We're giving it away, you know.
We're giving it away to the right kind of people who are members of my country club.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, you know, who go to the bar that I go to, buddies. But not to the people who really need it. And it's bizarre. I think it's gone on for a long time. And I really like my theory about the guilt, that if we're guilty about something, then we have to blame them in order to, you know, release our guilt.
Right, right. Exactly. If you're just in tune to the 18th Annual Homelessness Broadcast, that was the voice of Otis McClay. And on the line now, we have... Sean Canone, who refers to himself as a homeless advocate and a humanitarian. He was based in Hollywood, Florida. He was also building low-cost housing for poor people there. And so, Sean, first of all, welcome to the broadcast. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. An early morning to you. Before we start... I wanted to hear about the low-cost housing you were building, but talk to us about your own experience and how you came to become a homeless advocate and, as you say, a humanitarian.
Well, basically, I realized that giving somebody a home or to prevent them from being homeless is really a simple task. Basically, give them a roof and four walls, and they're not homeless anymore. But housing them, obviously, is complex, and that's the skill that shelter providers, you know, have to have in order to house the homeless. You know, anybody can really help the homeless and get them off the street. It's simply an easy task, but, you know, nowadays it becomes illegal to do such things.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so talk to us about your experience in trying to provide low-cost housing for poor people in Hollywood, Florida, and how you ended up leaving that city.
Well, basically, in the city of Hollywood, about 20 years ago, I ran into a homeless guy on the street. And he was very disheveled, mentally ill, and he was not doing very well. So I took him to the local hospital. He was there for about 4 weeks. He wasn't really able to talk. He was alone for such a long time. He just mumbled. The hospital called me and said that they were discharging him today. And I said, oh, great, where are you putting him at? They said, well, he has no home. He'll be going to the street.
Mm.
And I'm like, well, that's crazy. And why would you spend all this money getting this guy able to, you know, get him out of psych meds and so forth and then put him back to the street? And they said, well, there's no beds around. So I put him in an apartment. And about, I'd say 30 days later, I had 40 homeless people, and I started the shelter really with no ounce of planning. And it just grew to the largest provider in the county in about a year and a half.
And then I understand that you were incentivized to leave Hollywood, Florida. How did that come about?
Yeah, they didn't want me to do this after we got so big. After the city of Hollywood utilized their services more than any other city, but they decided to make it against the law. So they took us to court, and 5 years later we won and stayed there for about 10 years.
So let me, just to reiterate for our listening audience, it was made illegal for you to help house the homeless.
I couldn't do it anywhere in the city, basically, and everywhere I wanted to go, they denied. So, yeah, it essentially became illegal. That's when they took us to court, and the judge said there's only mall. Was ambiguous and too vague, and therefore we were allowed to stay. But they just put up a $353 million hotel resort in the city, and having a homeless shelter located very close to this resort wasn't conducive to the new city that they wanted to project. So we met, and they offered us $5 million to move the shelter, in which we did. We went 200 miles north to 25 minutes from Disney's main gate, and that also became a problem. They did not want 100 some homeless people in their community as well.
Well, you know, that seems like a recurring theme again and again. Otis and I were just talking about it, and many of the guests tonight have brought up that notion of, you know, businesses, resorts, gentrification, all moving out homelessness because they look at it as an eyesore.
Everybody wants to help the homeless, but nobody wants it in their backyard. The city commissioners talk out of both sides of their face. Just tonight, I went to a city commission meeting in the great city of Oakland Park. That's what the mayor called it. And they're making it illegal for a priest who's been feeding the homeless for 25 years. He already once had to move his church. And then tonight, we did a little civil disobedience. We got up there and pleaded with them to allow the church to continue to feed. And the priest continued to do what Jesus commands him to do, and that's in the book of Matthew, is to feed the poor. And the priest decided to do a little civil disobedience, and after he spoke, he went up to the city commission meeting with a sign and blocked the meeting, and about 20 other people blocked the meeting as well. And the mayor was really upset, but it's nice to see that, you know, they said he was breaking the law, and the priest replied, well, you know, when you deny me the right to feed under the Constitution, you're breaking the law as well. You know, Fort Lauderdale, of course, in our South Florida area, has always been one of the most dangerous places for the homeless to live. They seem to be hunted and killed in the South Florida area more than any other city in the country. Probably, I think, for the last 7 out of 9 years, Florida was one of the most dangerous states for the homeless to be. Mm-hmm. And the research has indicated that if communities target the homeless by making these food anti-food sharing laws and so forth, attacks in those areas go up. Well, it's simple. The mayors and the city commissioners are having meetings saying that they don't want the homeless in the area because they're bad people, it's bad for property values, they're going to molest my children. And when kids hear that, they say, oh, well, the mayor said they're bad people. Who's going to care if I kill one? And we have to understand what we're saying in front of these city commission meetings because that does set the mindset that it's our right. We should be able to beat up the homeless. And it shows what's happening in South Florida. But, you know, Fort Lauderdale just arrested a famous chef, Arnold Abbott, 91-year-old gentleman who's been feeding the homeless for probably just as long as Father Bob. Mm-hmm. And they arrested him. And in that five-day period of his life, he became more famous than Justin Bieber.
Mm-hmm.
When he got out of his vehicle to feed, there was choppers above, and almost every news source and the world came down to watch him get arrested. You know, from Russia to the Middle East, they sent news crews. Washington, D.C. sent news crews, and they watched him feed and get arrested. So America screwed up. You know, we talk about helping the vets. Give me a break. We don't help the vets. We make it illegal to house the vets. Don't feed the vets, even though we say we should help them and everybody wants to help them. You can't. You can get arrested for feeding the vets.
Well, and we've talked extensively about the criminalization of homelessness throughout this broadcast. Sean, if you don't mind, I want to first let folks know that they're in tune to the 18th Annual Homelessness Broadcast. My name is Katia, and on the line with us is Sean Canone, based in Florida. He is a homeless advocate and humanitarian. We want to go to our phones right now and talk to James in Tampa, Florida. Good evening. Good morning, James.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Your question or comment?
Oh, good morning. Who am I speaking with?
This is Katia. And on the line, we have our guest, James, Sean Canone, who is also in Florida.
Yeah, good morning. Actually, I know Sean. Sean, good morning.
Oh, hey, how are you? Now I know who you are.
Yeah, I've actually been over to Sean's homeless resort and really have an appreciation for what he does. And actually, I wish that more communities would actually look at that as a plus to have rather than, you know, try to tear them apart.
Absolutely. And did you?
Yeah, he said the word resort. We call it America's First Homeless Resort because we wanted the public to know that this is Housing First. We've been doing Housing First for almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
At first, we were criticized. So they said we were warehousing people, but now HUD seems to say get them in off the street, Housing First, and treat them later. And that's what we've been doing for 20 years. And this Housing First model was a good idea because we could take people. They didn't have to pay, but if they had money, they would pay. So they went. The fees were from $0 to $26 a day. If they couldn't work, couldn't pay, didn't have a check, they got to stay for free, which we called a Mother Teresa then. Now, if that's something wrong with taking people that would literally live on the street and then provide housing for them, it becomes criminal. I don't get it.
Well, talk to us, Sean. I mean, what, and James, if you want to weigh in here, why do you think a society would criminalize feeding, housing folks that don't have anything? I mean, you know, I'm sure you've thought about this question quite a bit. But what have you come up with? What answer can you find to that?
Well, a little about me is, real quick, is I run a page online, and you can find it at homelesslivesmatter.org.
And this is James.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I share a lot of stories from around the country. I've shared Sean's stories. And actually, there's a man, out of Michigan who has done similar to what Sean is doing, and that's Mike Carl. And Mike Carl has bought a hotel. Actually, he's working on buying the hotel, and he calls it, the Magnuson. He calls it the Maggie. And he gets calls all throughout the night to actually rescue people off of the streets and take them to live at his hotel. And what you're saying about the community and about people actually criminalizing and fearing homelessness, I think it's too easy for society to just look at people that are not like them or people that are going through issues in life and be afraid of them rather than to reach out and sit down and talk to them or learn more about them. Now, last December, I actually reunited a woman who'd been missing 3 years from her son and from across the country. She was living on the streets of Tampa, and she was lost with missing persons reports, having been arrested for trespassing, taken to jail, released. She was schizophrenic, so of course she's not going to go back to court, and then picked back up for failure to appear, all while having these missing persons reports out there for her that Tampa Police Department never found. And then put her back on the streets again, she's an animal to roam around and just ignore her.
Mm-hmm.
Because of me, I reunited her with her son, Tristan. are located him online. He flew to Tampa. That made that made a national news story covered by ABC Action News, where they were actually there when he drove up in the rental car, came straight from the airport to walk up to the bench and reunite with his mother. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing story. And just for people...
That's wonderful.
To look at somebody like that and just ignore her. I mean, it was incredible the amount of people that would chime in on the internet, like, oh, I saw her in the park. Oh, we fed her. Oh, we saw her at the Christmas tree lighting the other day. All of the same people that worked in downtown, worked in the county buildings, that saw the story or saw the pictures that were shared online of her and recognized her, but yet nobody ever cared to try to help this woman or find out about her.
Right. And if you just, Sean, if you just hold up 1 second for me, hold on 1 second. I just want to let folks know that if you're just joining us, you're in tune to the 18th annual National Homelessness Broadcast. My name is Katia, and we have Ray, who is a member of Denver Homeless Out Loud. He is homeless, and he's also he was one of 10 people arrested when Resurrection Village in Denver was torn down. We're going to get to you in just 1 second, Ray, but we want to go to Abdullah, who's been waiting in D.C., who has a question or comment. Good morning, Abdullah. Your question or comment?
Thank you. Here.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Abdullah Hakeem, and I've been listening to you for the last couple of hours, and I just thought I'd call. I'm a type of individual. I'm a homeless. I'm 66 years old, and I'm a homeless black man here in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And coming out of incarceration in July of 2015. And I heard a lot of good things. You know, I heard a lot of good things. I heard a lot of things that, you know, I'm talking from experience for dealing with homelessness, substance abuse, and incarcerated, coming out of incarceration and coming back into the society without having a support group or a network or a family that's supporting you. No money, no place to live, no job, no clothes, no nothing. And what had happened, it caused me to go back into comfortable revolving door being institutionalized. The next thing, alcohol and drugs kicking in with.
Abdullah, can I ask you just to hold that thought for 1 second? We have to take a quick break.
Okay.
Of just 30 seconds. We won't be long. And then we want to bring in, I think your story is very relevant to our guest, Ray, as well. We want to bring him in when we come back. So, again, you're in tune to the 18th Annual National Homelessness Broadcast. We'll be right back.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. You may send questions to #@HomelessnessM. That's @HomelessnessM. Live audio of this broadcast is also online at homelessnessmarathon.org.
And we're back, and again, this is the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon broadcast. That was the voice of a caller, Abdullah, homeless here in D.C., formerly incarcerated, returning citizen, 61 years of age. And I want to bring in, again, Abdullah and Sean, I want to bring into the conversation Ray out of Denver, Colorado. Ray is a part of Denver Homeless Out Loud, which is a successor of the group that formed Resurrection Village, and Ray was one of 10 people arrested when Resurrection Village was torn down. Good evening, Ray. Good morning. Ray, are you there?
This is Mr. Hakeem.
Ah, okay, Mr. Hakeem. I think we have Ray now as well. Ray, are you there?
Yeah.
Good evening. Good morning. I say good evening. It feels like even good morning. And thank you for joining us. We're just speaking with, there was a caller from D.C., Mr. Hakeem, who just told us about his story of being a returning citizen and is actually now homeless. And we know that you were one of 10 people arrested when Resurrection Village was torn down. Can you talk to us about that experience and how returning citizens fit into the paradigm of homelessness there in Denver, Colorado?
Resurrection Village happened on October 24th. We had built two tiny homes and three Conestoga huts with are just little round shelters. They're actually internationally, the building code on them is internationally acceptable. We built them, we squatted and built these Conestoga huts. It took us, these five tiny homes, and it took us like 8 hours to build them. And after that 8 hours, we were told that we were trespassing and we were going to have to leave. We had probably 200 people there helping us. Most everybody left, but 10 of us decided we weren't going anywhere because I believe it was 159 people died in Denver last year, and the homeless people died last year. And we wanted to make sure that people were safe and had covering. And after they arrested us, they tore the Conestoga huts down, stole the tiny homes, and wouldn't give them back to us. And after that, we got out of jail, and I've been staying there since then. We have a small hole in the wall at El Centro Humanitario, which is a work program for basically mostly immigrants, and some of them are illegal. Most of those people are homeless. There's a huge Hispanic and immigrant group here in Denver that are homeless.
I see. And Abdullah, you heard what Ray had to say about some of the solutions there, and we talked about that, the tiny home solution for D.C. How would, as someone who is homeless presently, what do you think of that solution for D.C.?
I listened to the audio. They were talking about 801. I've been to 801. I was in the transition program, which was a very good program. And one of the things I had to learn in the beginning of my recovery, not just from alcohol and drugs, but my behavior and the way I think. A counselor gave me a book entitled Book of As a Man Thinks, so it's easy. He said, Mr. Hakeem, nothing will change for you until you change your way of thinking. And today I believe in that, you know, until I change my way of thinking, nothing's going to change for me. Alcohol and the drugs, when that kicked in, alcohol and drugs is not the real addiction, it's just the symptoms of the addiction, which is my character defects like anger, resentment, and so on and so on. So instead, I had to start dealing with my behavior. I could not be treated, because see, I could be in prison on the outside. I don't have to be in prison on the inside. I could be in prison within my mind walking the streets of Washington, you know. So until I changed my way of thinking, then I could be free. But what had happened because of my homeless, if an individual don't have shelter, you can't hold a job, you can't take a bath, you can't cook for yourself, you can't get proper rest. So it's a process. It's a combination of things. You know what I'm saying? And what happened is I got frustrated and depressed and anxiety and depression. And what happened? I turned back to drugs and alcohol, which did not help the situation. It made the situation a lot worse. So I was constantly digging a hole. And what had happened was I found out that through all the programs and transition programs, you know, and I listen very carefully tonight, and I hear some good things, but I find that a lot of people that are in positions that to help the homeless and all people who come out of incarceration, treatment program, male or female, everybody don't have your best interest. You got to really want this. You really got to want it and go through whatever you have to go through to get it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And it's not easy when you don't have shelter. Right now, I had an individual invite me into their home tonight. I'm actually sleeping on the floor listening to y'all.
God bless you, Mr. Hakeem.
Absolutely. And, wow. And the question is, how many of us say, well, you know, we got an extra bedroom, or we got those, we know that they can go and invite somebody in the home. We don't do that, you know. Mm. And I think about when I was coming as a kid, there was no such thing as home, you know, because, you know, right. your aunt, you stay with an aunt and mama, you know, you live some, you weren't on no street, and you didn't go home. You know, it wasn't until I got to D.C. that I realized about home, you know what I mean? Like, what is this? You know. But
we thank you. I don't I hope you don't think of me as rude, but we have another guest joining the conversation, and I want to also give time to those that might want to try to call in. We have limited number of phone lines, but we so appreciate you calling, and you know, again, bless you and the family that you're staying with tonight. That is how we take care of each other. So thank you for sharing your story. And Doug is on the line, and we're going to get to him in just a moment, but I want to go back to Sean for a minute, because Mr. Hakeem brought up something that is very relevant in that. So at your homeless resort, Sean, how do you deal with people perhaps changing their attitudes, perhaps utilizing their frustration, their sadness, their anger to propel them into a different kind of consciousness, so that their plight of being homeless doesn't eat them up?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that our providers, and this is the main reason why the government shelters really haven't worked, the roles are very, very tight, where we expect them to come in, change their life in a matter of a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Shelter providers have to conform. They have to think like the homeless person. They have to give them breaks. I have been spit on by some of my clients over the years. I have a client that's been with me 19 years. He has spit on me at least 5 times. He kicked me twice. He doesn't do it because he hates me. He has an incident where he can't control himself and he gets frustrated. But we love him and we deal with him. And there has to be a place for everybody, every sort of homeless person to be able to go to. And those tiny homes are a place where they can go to, so they can be by themselves if they're frustrated by living in large groups of people. But I just want to answer your question, Matt, going back. You said, why do people not want to help the homeless?
Mm-hmm.
You know, about 10 years ago, there was a gentleman who took a picture of a starving black child in the dirt. And 10 feet from the child was a buzzard bird waiting for that child to die. This is what the world has become. We're now allowing buzzards to wait until a child dies to eat that child for food. Now, that's messed up.
Mm-hmm.
We have our hearts where we say, you know what, the starving kids are going to die. It's just a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
30,000 people die in third world nations every day. 30,000. Doing this interview right now, maybe 1,500 people have just died of starvation.
Mm.
America is now setting the tone. It's hard in our hearts. It's all right. There's going to be homeless people there. They'll die off. They'll eventually die. And we won't have to treat them, and our Medicaid will go back in a profitable state.
Wait, Sean, let me stop you right there, if I may, just for a moment. We have a guest calling in from Sweden, and we want to make sure we get him in. He has a very limited amount of time. Welcome, Doug Seegers. Are you there?
Hello. Yeah, I'm still here. I'm listening to your program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Well, can you share your remarkable story with our listeners? There are many in the listening audience that may not be familiar, but you were, as I understand it, homeless, living in Nashville, singing in Nashville, and literally discovered by two other Swedish musicians who happened to be there. Is that correct?
That is correct. And, you know, as far as the homeless issue is concerned, it wasn't only just 3 years ago that I was homeless and recognized for my music. I've been homeless on and off my entire life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nothing that was, you know, that whole thing about living in poverty and living on the bridge, you know. That wasn't anything new to me when that 3 year ago incident happened to me.
And
I mean, it was the kind of a lifestyle that I had, you know, pretty much grown to conquer. You know, survival for me, or, you know, for other people out there, is the thing where it involves a little bit of knowledge, it involves a little bit of knowing who's out there that wants to help you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And once you get that down, once you figure that out, and if you have to ask maybe another friend who's been homeless for quite a while, you know, he's going to... I had a friend of mine, I was sleeping under a bridge, and I woke up with him one morning, and he as soon as we woke up, he looked at me, and he said, come on, let's get up. I'm going to take you across the street for breakfast. And I said, what? I've got no money for breakfast. And he said, no, there's a church right across the way that they give you free breakfast every Sunday morning, you know, stuff like that. You know, I mean, you got to get involved knowing what's available for you, you know.
How to negotiate things so that you can survive. I think.
Yeah, your survival. Your survival back in the 40s, you know, that was, to me, that was a challenge, and that was hard. That was hard times, okay? And I hate to speak, and I hope I'm not getting anybody else upset by saying this, but for me, survival was not a real the thing where there's any pain or where there's any, you know, it wasn't that much of a challenge. It was a small challenge, but it was adventurous for me. You know, it was something where it wasn't the thing where it affected my moods or my personality. You know, it was just time that I was going through, and I had to just make sure I knew where my proper connections were, you know.
Mm-hmm. And may I ask you, because I know your time is limited, I wanted to ask you about how your music changed your status of homelessness and the feeling you had when you were living on the street versus after you had met with some acclaim and that condition was no longer present.
Well, it was something that, let me try and see if I could back up just a little bit so I could tell you the basis behind my recognition in my music is the fact that I had was involved with a relationship 3.5 years ago, and the woman that I was with, she was living under the bridge with me, but she, for some apparent reason, decided to leave me, and I actually started falling down even harder and drinking heavier, and you know, I was on drugs and alcohol at the time, and I got myself to a point where I was so messed up, I decided that I needed to call on God, you know, and tell him that I needed his help to get out of my mess. I was just totally messed up, you know. And I was sitting outside of an abandoned church one afternoon, and I actually even had I was drinking. I had a bottle of vodka with me, and I had about a bottle in me, and I looked up into the sky, and I said a prayer, and I said, God, I need your help. Please get me out of this. I can't do it alone. And that's pretty much what happened to me. And the reason I need to tell you that is because that happened. That whole incident happened to me about 3 weeks prior to me meeting Jill Johnson in Nashville, okay? So the way I chalked that whole thing up is God was proud of me, and he also saw me as a person that could go out there and be a living testimony. So I'm actually in training right now. You know, when I write my music, I take my music out to the streets, and I try to inspire other addicts and alcoholics out there with what my experience was, you know.
Well, you know, we saw your music online, and I have to say it is lovely. And we thank you for your music, and we thank you for taking the time to be with us this morning. I don't know how much time you have, if you can hold on, or it would be better for you if we let you go at this moment.
No, I'm fine. I'm in no hurry.
Okay, perfect. All right, because I want
it. I'm perfectly willing to talk about anything you'd like to talk about.
Okay, wonderful. Well, because I want to bring Ray and Robbie back into the conversation as well as Sean. But with Ray in particular and Robbie, I want to talk to you about what Doug said about negotiating survival on the street and really cultivating and building this kind of network of relationships that helps one do that. Can you all talk about your experiences?
Yeah, if I could just go back to these three, all three of these callers, they all had something in common.
Since we have so many now, can you identify yourself so we know who we're listening to?
This is Ray from Colorado.
Okay, very good, Ray. Go ahead.
Okay, one of the things about the tiny homes, and you'll hear it in the call from D.C., from Sean, and from the gentleman in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
All of them said something. The caller from Nashville said, he couldn't do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Sean said we needed to love them. And then the DC caller also talked about community.
Mm-hmm.
All of these guys are all talking about the same thing, community. And that's where it tends to come together. There was a study about Rat Park in the 70s about heroin addicts, where if you got them into community, all of a sudden they weren't heroin addicts anymore. And it's the same thing with homelessness. When we survive on the street, when we're doing our thing on the street, we need to come together. We come together, and there's 18 people sleeping under a tree right now,
mm-hmm.
that I just woke up from, and we're a community.
Mm-hmm.
We work at things together. When somebody comes out and says, oh, you know, they're a little drunk and they want to pull a knife or something, those people get up and we get together and say, hey, you can't do that here. Surviving on the street in Denver, you never go hungry. There's a lot of places to eat here, but there's people that prey on the homeless. There's the drug dealers. A lot of the partiers downtown will come by and bother the homeless. That's the thing with the tiny homes. The tiny homes are a community where we can just say, you can live here. It's worked in Oregon. It's worked in Washington. And we're really wanting it to work here. I think that if we get people together and say, look, you know, and men have a hard time with that whole love thing. Every time I say it, I kind of feel like, oh, I'm not being a man. And we have to get over that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big thing to come together and have that love for each other. And it'll take the alcohol off out of their life. It'll help them with the drugs. It'll take that out of their life. It'll take behavioral issues. A lot of behavioral issues will come. People with behavioral issues will come in and they'll change over maybe 2 weeks. They'll start feeling like they fit somewhere, and I think that's the key. Housing is not the key. Homes are the key.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody says, well, they're unhoused. I hate that term because we're not unhoused. We don't have homes. Big difference. There's a big difference in having a home and having a shelter or four walls.
Right.
If you give them, give people something that they can believe in, and they have dignity about that, you know, that they're doing that. It's their self, and their community is helping them. I think would go a lot farther.
That's an excellent point, and I want to bring in another guest. We have Robbie Kelly right now, who is in Nashville and who lives in an illegal homeless encampment in Nashville. Good evening or good morning, Robbie. Good. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Did you hear Ray's last point about you're not without a home, a house, you're without a home? That is the issue, having community. So how this illegal encampment, talk to us about how community works there and how it's made a difference in terms of being homeless.
Oh, well, the community out here is kind of loose. I mean, we're dealing with a bunch of homeless people, you know.
Are there people that know each other? Do you know the other people that you're living with in the encampment?
Oh, of course. I know everybody who's here. I mean, it's kind of loose, but, you know, we come together as a community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's helped a whole lot, you know, being around people that understand you. And, you know, we're going through some of the same growing pains. And, you know, you're right, I'm without a home, but I'm not homeless.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a house. And the people around me, because, you know, they help me out, keep me stable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do all right up here. It's not really as bad as people think it is.
And what about the threat of it, since it is an illegal encampment, what about the threat, or do you worry about the threat of it being dismantled at any moment by the government, by the police?
Oh, yes, of course. But right now, no. They kind of, we have a new mayor, Mayor Barry down here. She's actually been kind of great. She's put a stop to any harassment from the city.
Really?
Until April 15th. And she's also appointed a task force to, you know, oversee the camps. You know, right now they're talking about doing something similar to what Seattle's done. You know, they're trying to approve sanction camps. So right now, we're kind of like, you know, we're waiting to see what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you the composition of the encampment? Is it mostly individuals without families? Are there children present? What is the makeup of the encampment?
Oh, right now we kind of have a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have women. We don't have any children at the moment, but we have. We have some of the mentally ill. You know, we have some drug addicts and alcoholics. And, you know, we have some guys that just, you know, just get out of penitentiary and don't have anything.
Mm-hmm. We have returning citizens there as well.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, let me remind you that that was the voice, first of all, of Robbie Kelly, who lives in an illegal homeless encampment in Nashville, Texas. This is the 18th annual homelessness marathon. And gentlemen, we just have a few more moments to go in this segment. If you don't mind, I'd like to get final thoughts from each of you, and I'd also like to find out who you're endorsing for this presidential election. Sean, may I start with you?
Sure. Before I give my final thought, I just want to remember all of us to remember that our dear leader, our the homeless czar, Michael Stoops,
mm-hmm.
Is very sick right now, needs our prayers. Michael has been a leader of the United States. I would be able to call Michael Stoops at 3 in the morning when we had a problem. He's always at his desk working. So tonight, let's all take a little moment to say short of a prayer when you get home and hope for him to recover his illness. Who am I endorsing? I'm a Democrat, obviously.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM. It's Bathrobe's Piers Broadside.
That will help the poor, but that just may be talking out of both sides of the mouth. I've supported financially Mrs. Clinton in the past, and I intend to support her. I don't think she did anything illegal. It was up to the government to tell her not to use the server, not for her to just used it. They knew she was using it. They should have intervened. So I don't think she did anything illegal. Final thoughts. We need to understand that helping the homeless can be done. It's easy. These tiny homes are fantastic. There needs to be a safe zone in every city. Now, I'm not talking about the 10th city, but sort of like a 10th city where the homeless can go. They can be at least given at least 2 meals a day and some sort of shelter. And if that is done, they won't be arrested. And then we can triage them and case manage them from these areas. And those who want housing first can get housing first. Those who need detox.
Thank you, Sean. I'm sorry, I just need to leave your comments there. We only have a minute, and I need to get in Ray and Robbie. Again, that was the voice of Sean Canone out of Florida. He is an advocate and a humanitarian, and he builds and runs low-cost housing for the homeless. Thank you so much, Sean. And Ray, very quickly, your endorsement and final thought?
Final thought, I'd like to agree with Michael Stoops is awesome. I just want to say that. My endorsement, right now I'm thinking probably Sanders. I won't go into all the political details and all that. And final thoughts, I'd like to say just everybody in the United States listening to this right now needs to talk to somebody about building tiny homes. I think they're a huge answer. They're not the solution, they're a solution.
Thank you so much, Ray. And again, that was Ray from Denver Homeless Out Loud. Thank you so much. And Robbie, finally, out of Nashville, your endorsement and your very quick final thought.
Okay, well, I'm not really, I'm really waiting for the smoke to clear. I'm hoping other candidates may step forward. But Sanders is looking good right now.
Okay.
I got my eye on him.
Okay, very good. And your final thought?
And my final thoughts are, you know, I hear a lot of talk about these pallet homes they're building, and they sound pretty good, but
I'm in the tent city that I'm living in. Well, we live in tents, and I kind of like tents better. I don't know about the box house. Mm-hmm. It may be a good thing for some, but for some, it's not so good. You know, we kind of like our tent city. We kind of like it freestanding.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, there you have it. And again, Robbie Kelly is living currently in an illegal homeless encampment in Nashville, Texas. Thank you so much for taking time out to be with us. Again,
it's no problem.
Okay, you take good care. And if you're just joining us, it's not over yet. We're moving into hour number Hour number 12, yes. And it's going to be our fifth hour of our homeless walk around the White House. You're in tune to the 18th annual Homelessness Marathon.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. You may send questions to #@HomelessnessM. That's @HomelessnessM. Live audio of this broadcast is also online at homelessnessmarathon.org. You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. You may send questions to #@HomelessnessM. That's @HomelessnessM. Live audio of this broadcast is also online at homelessnessmarathon.org. Welcome to the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free number for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody, followed by the number 8. If you are homeless, formerly homeless, or about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. There's broad agreement that there are a lot of psychologically challenged people on the streets, but that's about the only point there's agreement on. There's broad disagreement as to why they're there and what to do with them or for them. We'll discuss these issues and then talk with an attorney in Shoreline, Washington, who's got a homeless camp in his backyard, right after this.
Walking into the Houdon household is like entering a giant slumber party mid-swing. Every couple of minutes, this happens. 17-year-old Jamari House sits on a pile of stuffed animals, eating a chicken strip. Her best friend, Angel Houdon, lounges by the couch, and Angel's older sister, Ivory, sits ramrod straight on a kitchen chair, shirt buttoned all the way to the top. The friendly conversation turns into a sisterly squabble, Jamari throwing comments toward her friend-turned-sister.
It's nobody's chore, but you could take the initiative to clean the bathroom.
It's your chore to at least clean the sink. Come on, man.
But you do all the makeup.
Jamari moved in with the Houdons about 3 years ago. She met Ivory in orchestra class. They became friends, and Ivory invited her over one day. Jamari was surprised when they got off the bus from Bartlett High School and walked up to the Houdon split-level house.
I honestly forgot people lived in houses. I really did. Like, because of how many times I've been in apartments or shelters, and my grandma lived in a trailer.
Jamari can remember at least 9 places she's lived with her mother and twin brother, sometimes with her mom's boyfriends, sometimes with relatives. Her dad died when she was only 4. By the time she started high school, she was staying in a 2-bedroom apartment with a crowd of relatives.
We stayed with my cousin who had 5 children and had a baby coming on the way. So that wasn't too fun because the baby would be crying all night or I'd have to babysit and not be able to finish all my homework.
Jamari had always been the smart academic type, but her grades were slipping. She was barely making low B's and C's. Sam, Angel and Ivory's mom, says the first time she met Jamari and heard about her situation, she saw elements of her own childhood, substance abuse and instability. Jamari's personality reflected it.
She was shy, nervous a lot. It took probably about 4 months for her to open up and just be a little giggle fest or an angry ball of I hate homework, which happens a lot now.
One weekend about 3 years ago, Jamari spent the night. They watched The Little Mermaid and played Mario Kart. And then she never really left.
She was here for about 2 weeks and I was like, don't you need to go home to see your mom? And she's like, oh, my mom doesn't care. I was like, okay.
But her mom, Monica House, did care. Monica says she knew she couldn't provide her kids with a stable home. She was struggling with depression and substance abuse after her husband and then her brother and her aunt died. Her son went to live with a friend, and Jamari went to stay with Sam and her kids.
Finding Sam, her finding Sam, that was the best thing, even if it wasn't with me, that was the best thing that could have happened.
And in the 3 years since moving to the Houdon's house, Jamari's grades have climbed. Now she's an A student and is applying to colleges. And she says her personality has changed.
Well, I've gotten more comfortable with myself and with the girls. I'm a bit more able to speak more comfortably. Like, they encourage me.
Ivory, the no-nonsense sister, says Jamari changed their family, too. Jamari moved in soon after Ivory's father moved out. Ivory says, together, they're a real family.
My family interacts, and not only is it the interactions that happen, is that we're able to be happy and angry together. And it used to be where no one's allowed to have emotions, and no one's allowed to really be themselves. After the divorce and people were moving in and out, I got to have a family, for once.
Jamari was never legally adopted by Sam, and she still has a relationship with her biological mom. Monica has her own place now, and Jamari spends every other weekend with her. But her new family and her new home have given her roots she's never had before. And even though she's preparing to leave for college, she never wants to give it up.
I'm like, you can't move, Sam. Why? Because it's a safe place. Safe, stability. Everything, it's good. Don't move, because if you move, then I'll kind of flip out, because I want to come back to this house. Like, if I move out of state or something and come back and she's moved somewhere else, I'll be like, where did you move? Why aren't you home? Who's these people here?
She finishes her after-school snack, sinking further into the pile of toys and contentedly putting off her pile of homework. She's comfortable, happy, and home.
This piece was produced by Ann Hillman of the Urban Affairs Desk at Alaska Public Media. The Homelessness Marathon is experiencing technical difficulties. These are excerpts from last year's marathon. We will return to the live broadcast as quickly as possible.
You're supposed to, when you get out of prison, you're supposed to be released to an address, but the address that you get released to is a homeless shelter.
Yeah, they have said repeatedly in many different forms that they don't do that. The parole board says we don't do that. The APA downtown says we don't do that. No one will acknowledge that this is what they do, but yet they can email, they'll fax you paperwork before you release, like they did me, and say this is where you must report. You must report to 2100 Lakeside. There is no question that this is what they do. They parole you to the street. They help make you homeless.
Taryn, let me ask you, and I know there's people thinking this out there, okay? You sound articulate, You know, you may have messed up, but you're a capable person. Why don't you just go get a job and get an apartment and get out of the shelter?
Well, see, the disease of addiction just gets to you in such a way that over the years, you go from job to job to job. And after a certain period of time, you can make up a resume and go out and put resumes in and put applications in and try to have interviews with people. And they look at your resume and they look at your application and they wonder, what's wrong with this guy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why can't he hold on to a job? You know, and I'm starting to get my life together now and I'm having a hard time finding a job because nobody wants to hire someone with basically the track record that I have for employment. Some of the jobs that I've had, I was a very good worker at. Anybody that knows people that are in recovery will tell you that we're very hard workers,
right.
Very hard workers, and we just need to get that chance. We need someone to give us that chance to get back into the workforce, to get back into living life, and becoming useful citizens again. You know, so people don't look at us and look down their nose at us and so on.
Is this a case of God may forgive you, but society won't?
Bingo. You got it right there. God, my God looks at me and he says, you know what? He says, whatever you've done, it's okay. But get up and wipe yourself off and move forward. And society doesn't do that. They still look down their nose at you and say, you know what? You're not worthy. You're not worth it.
They're sitting up there spending more money abroad than they are at home. I always thought charity begins at home and then abroad.
Right.
If you address the issue of how many homeless people you have here in this country alone, think of how much money you sunk into the different wars that have been going on. Half of that money could have been spent to alleviate half of the strain that's on the system.
As a homeless person, are you bitter about that?
I'm not really bitter. I'm confused by it. It doesn't make sense.
I understand that you got a dishonorable discharge and it's hard to really move forward with something like that. But there is hope for you. You can always come to 2100, get into a program.
Man, that's and, like a mini city of wars, man. They had a 19-year-old kid killed there last week.
At 2100?
A 19-year-old kid.
Is that true?
Honest to God, I ain't lying.
You come to 2100, get into a program, mm-hmm. and you get your low-income housing. You just got to do the program.
Where are you living now?
You got a bridge over here next to us over here?
Yep.
Right here.
You're living under the bridge.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I advise you to come to 2100, get into a program, and within 6 months, you have some housing.
Well, it's old people, man, are really discriminated down there, man. The young people, they play Terminator down there. I'm not sure.
No, if you're over 50, they help you.
Yeah, if you've been down here, you know what I'm talking about.
You're over 50, they'll help you.
I'm not saying they're going to help you, but can you survive? Can you live there while you're doing it, getting help?
Okay, JB wants to say something.
That's not true. I work under one of the primary coordinators groups there at the shelter. And that simply isn't true. We open our doors, our hearts, our minds, our souls, everything to everybody that comes into that door, into that building. We even go outside and, especially my boss, he's gone out and taken guys off the street that refuse to even come into a shelter. No shelter, no homeless environment is 100% plus safe. You're going to have your negative responses. You're going to have your negative circumstances no matter how you look at it, no matter what you do. None of it is absolutely perfect. If it was perfect, it wouldn't be needing the assistance that it does. So you're going to have those bad elements. Unfortunately, yes, that was a death that occurred outside the building, not inside. And it was not at the fault of the community there. They did everything they could to protect everyone there. Everyone is protected as best they can. And the elderly people are most absolutely looked after. They get the greatest concern. It's just that our budget does not allow us to be...
Excuse me, JB. I put up with a lot of stuff on this show, but I am not going to have someone in their 50s referred to as elderly. I'm in my 50s.
I'm 53, almost 54.
All right, now you're trending on the fighting side of me.
Talking about is that we have a couple of gentlemen down at the community right now that are over 80 and 90 years old.
And the reason that I say what I do about discrimination for the elderly in homeless shelters is because, especially in 2100, the older people I know, most of them, they band together. We stay together because there's it's more safety in numbers, first of all. A lot of young kids out there, they come in from prison, they come in from all kinds of areas, and they don't care about nothing, man. They just drop them off from the damn bus that comes out from the state penitentiary, drops them off right in front. I've seen it. I've seen a van pull up there, drop off 12 convicts that were just released because of a reason, whatever. They served time, whatever. And these guys don't care. They're playing Terminator. They're beating up on people. They're intimidating them. They're trying to take their money. A little bit of cigarettes you have, they're going to steal, and you can't do nothing. You go up to see one of these supervisors, like JB. I'm not saying it's you, JB, okay? But I'm just saying there's a lot of these supervisors over there. They don't care about what you got. Someone takes your cigarettes. Who cares? They're not going to go looking for people. And if you rat people out, you're going to get beat down. This is the world of homelessness. This is the world of youth over the ages. Age people, man. The older people are the ones that suffer more when they're homeless than the regular people.
The Homelessness Marathon is experiencing technical difficulties. You are listening to excerpts from last year's marathon. We will return to the live broadcast as quickly as possible.
Well, I'm in two places at once tonight because I'm nobody, and at the microphone we have nobody from Nebraska. Nobody, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
How you doing?
Well, good. What's on your mind, nobody?
Yeah, I just want to say, they're sugarcoating this, you know, and all three of them sitting up there know better. 2100 is a hellhole. That's the bottom line. I've seen people get hurt, and they talk about the way things are down there and all this. Come and look. That's all I can say for you is come and look for yourself. Come and look in there. Look at how nasty it is in there, how people do this and do that and run here and run that, sell this, sell that, threaten other people. Yeah, you know, they got sections in there that they call the good section or whatever, the emergency section. Before I left them over there this evening, two dudes were getting ready to rumble right in the front door about a sandwich. You know, there's some churches that stopped coming there because they acted so crazy, getting lined up to go get something to eat, fighting to get in the line. And, you know, I see some dudes that they're looking at me, but they know I'm telling the truth. They know it. That's sugarcoat and stuff.
You live there?
Yes, I do.
So you're saying it's not a good shelter?
No, it's not a good place.
Let me ask you something. Have you ever gone to any of these other places around town here?
Yes, I have.
Let me finish the question first. Have you ever gone to any of these other places around town here that do serve dinners and food and not seen a rumble? Be honest. Not seen a rumble ever in your life at any of these other places?
Right. You know why?
You never have?
You want to know why?
Why?
Because the other people have a lot more control. If you act up there, you're gone.
Okay.
You're gone. That's it. You're gone.
Guess what? It's the same thing at 2100. I've seen many men get put out. Stuff.
I was homeless at first, and I didn't know how to handle myself. At least I had a friend that helped me out and everything. And everything went on good. He got me actually in a place. So I actually got a place in Lakewood, Cleveland area. But
Tommy, let me ask you this. Are you saying then really that it was critical that you had some support system? Having a friend is what made the difference for you?
Yes.
And in that sense, do you think it's the function of government to be essentially a friend to the people who don't have friends?
Yes. I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets and all this.
You know, I was able to get through it. I suppose I was clever sometimes, and I was lucky sometimes, and I finally managed to get my feet on the ground and a couple of paychecks and. I'm older now. I think it was easier when I was younger to be in that situation. You know, it's not as easy anymore. I'm sure that if someone people find themselves homeless now, don't have it a lot harder than I did when I was young. It was just easier.
As far as the numbers of people experiencing homelessness who are also dealing with mental illness. If you check all the numbers, you'll find that the numbers are pretty close to the numbers of people who are housed. But if you put somebody outside, you know, on February 15th, with the temperature the way it is now, those mental illnesses are exacerbated, and they come out more. They don't have anywhere warm to be. You know, you get frustrated. You know, so being homeless brings about brings those mental illnesses to the forefront.
Yeah, I used to have a friend who would say that if you're not crazy when you become homeless, homelessness will make you crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absolutely true.
I was going to mention that.
Yeah.
That's great. So, what do you guys see as the biggest issues facing the homeless mentally ill today?
For me, the biggest issue is for the country to get away from, if they're not a danger to themselves or others, leave them alone. I equate that to the sacred cows of India. You know, those cattle allow to wander the streets. They don't feed them. They don't take care of them because the gods will take care of them. Well, I feel that we're doing the same thing in this country with people who are experiencing homelessness. If they're not a danger to themselves or others, we leave them alone. And I feel we need to get away from that. I used to have a hard time saying that until I came to the realization that it applied to myself. I spent 2 years wandering the streets of D.C. totally mentally lost before I even started trying to rebuild my life. I should not have been allowed to wander the streets of D.C. for 2 years, you know. So I think that needs to change. A lot of people who are on the street right now are a little bit of medication and some counseling away from having a fulfilling life. But because we can't make people do what's best for them, they get to stay in the street.
And I'd say the two things that are really lacking are access and outreach. I would differ just a little bit with Alan in that I don't think that we need to necessarily start picking people up against their will. Although, I mean, there are definitely a lot of people out there who don't know that they need as much help as they do and they're resistant to treatment and we're just letting them die. But I think there's a happy medium between rounding them up and ignoring them, you know, and that is doing serious outreach. When I was homeless here in Washington and also in New York City for 2.5 years, mostly on the street, I didn't get a single person, not a social worker, an outreach worker, or a street worker, or a person working with a church or a charity, coming to me to approach me about mental health services, even though I was visibly very mentally ill. I mean, I have schizoaffective disorder, and when I'm not on my medication, you can tell. I always used to say to Alan that I think he has it much worse because when you're depressed, you know, people just tell you to cheer up. But when you're schizophrenic, it's very obvious that there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
But nobody, I mean, I was just left out there in the wilderness, like Alan said. And I think that we have to make a serious effort to get these people engaged, because you're not always out of it. No matter how sick people are, they're not always out of it. And you have to build relationships with people so that in the moment where they are willing to get help, they know that it's available immediately. But right now, we don't do that. We don't have enough outreach workers. We don't have enough case workers. The first time that I got into case management, it was court mandated, and the case manager didn't even show up half the time because she had so many clients. And then we have very few residential treatment beds for people who can't afford to pay for their own. And that's just not tenable. I mean, if you have a really serious mental illness, there's probably going to be times in your life where you need residential treatment. And if it's not available for whatever reason, and it largely has to do with the fact that we're not allowed to use Medicaid dollars to expand our mental health treatment capacity, which is something that Congress is looking at right now, but it has to do with, you know, our mindset of deinstitutionalization, and the institutions were terrible, but now you've gone so far in the other direction that the help is not there for people when they need it. And then the other thing that I think needs to change is people need better access to the medications that are going to help them. A lot of people have the mistaken belief that Obamacare, that the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid, all these other things get people the help that they need. But oftentimes, the medications that they do need that work best for them aren't covered. They get pushed off on other medications that are similar, and generic and don't work as well, but are easier, more easily affordable to the insurer or to the, you know, state if they're on Medicaid. And the result is more relapses. The result is a lower success rate and more homelessness. So more access and outreach is what I would say needs to change.
I'd like to echo what Dave said about the Biddle Hospital in the country at one time. True, they were very bad places. But I feel they should have been reformed and not closed. Because what they did was they said, okay, you're not a danger to yourself or other. Here's the medication you need to take. You can go now. What they failed to understand or realize, I don't know, is that most of these people would not keep up with their medication regimen. So they got sick again right away. There are people today, homeless on the streets of D.C., who came out of St. Elizabeth's Hospital when it was closed.
Over a decade ago. And not everybody needs medication. Or yeah, not everybody people, even people who it might help don't want to take it, but could respond to other therapies.
Right.
It's just that those other therapies, talk therapy and other more intensive therapies, are more expensive. And so that was really what it comes down to. It's a lot cheaper to give somebody a generic pill once a day or a shot once a week and send them on their way.
The system we have here in D.C. is also overwhelmed. You know, when I first started my recovery from homelessness, I got pretty decent care from the homeless health system, but it was tremendously overwhelmed. I know I went one day and I was told to come back in 6 weeks. If I hadn't gotten to a point in my life where I was determined to fight for my life, I may not have showed up 6 weeks later. But I got to a point where I planned my suicide, and that's what gave me the determination to fight back and save my life. And, you know, a lot of people, when you tell them to come back in 6 weeks, it's not going to happen. You know, so we need a bigger system. We need more money in the system. I know that's a bad word, but that's what we need.
Okay. So you mentioned the closing of St. Elizabeth, and I wanted to ask you all, what are the roots of the crisis that we now have in terms of the mentally ill who are homeless? Are we still lingering with the effects of so many mentally ill being released into the community from treatment institutions by President Reagan in the 1980s? Or have we moved into a next wave of those people who are mentally ill and homeless?
Both are correct. We're still dealing with people from St. Elizabeth, and we're dealing with people who are just coming to the streets now and suffering from mental illness. So both of those are correct.
Yeah, and I would say that it's important to remember that most of these illnesses that we're talking about, these serious chronic mental illnesses, these are lifetime illnesses. And so people who were young when they were moved out of St. Elizabeth 15 years ago are going to be in the system being treated for the next 60 years. So it's not something that we can forget about. And yeah, just like Alan, I know people who used to be residents there who ended up on the street. I had a friend named Romel who was being treated at St. Elizabeth, ended up on the street and homeless after it got downsized, and ended up developing physical illness and drug addiction as a result of his homelessness. His mental health was so much worse on the outside than it was just when he was in St. Elizabeth, as bad as it was, and as bad as it still is. St. Elizabeth is not a great place.
No.
But like Alan says, we don't need fewer beds. We need to reform the residential treatment, because people need it.
Mm-hmm.
People need it desperately.
Well, I want to thank my guests, David Pirtle and Alan Banks of the National Coalition for the Homeless. When we come back, we'll speak to three guests who can tell us firsthand what it was like to struggle with mental illness and homelessness. Two more guests. Stay with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the homeless that I wrote, and you can read over it. The lady said it was all right. The fine print there.
We're listening to the 18th annual Homelessness Marathon.
I was going to read it for you.
We're still on.
Yeah, we're on the radio.
Okay, we are on the radio.
I'm here on
my head. Where I lay my head? I lay my mind.
I was going to read it.
Really?
I'm from Street 6. I'm Elmar Road. Okay. Are you ready? How y'all doing this evening, ladies and gentlemen? I write for Street 6, the homeless newspaper, and this is a prayer that all the homeless people say all across the world. Where I lay my head, I lay my mind, body, and soul under God's kingdom. My bed is the earth, and he once walked among us. My TV is always on. I see many things as I look up at heaven's gate. I hear the drums of the rodents running around my bed, and then the sound of foot traffic walking up and down. My M3 player has a mixed sound to it. I hear the auto doors opening and closing. The buses stop at my front door all morning long. It's that time. The TV turns off automatically, and God's kingdom is opening up his gates. He's letting the ray of hope shine over his kingdom on earth. Well, let me walk this earth until God's kingdom open his gates once again. Bless you all, by Al Morrow. And if you didn't know, my bed was that bus stop that you walk back and forth. I have another one for you.
Okay.
That's all right. Now, you see a lot of people walking around the street, you know, sick. And you're wondering, how can you help? Well, let me read something to you that I wrote. If you see me, notice me. If you see a homeless person in the streets across America, we don't need your pity or your sympathy. A kind word will do, or a prayer for all of us. And if you have some cash, by all means, give it from the heart, not from your pocket. If not, just smile. And remember this, at that dinner table, that food that you're about to throw away. Yes, I've done that too. Wrap that food up and pass it on to someone who will need it. Remember, feed the mind, the body, and the soul, and everything else will come together. Can I get an amen? And thank you. Another thing. I'm with Street Sense, and there are over 700,000 homeless people in America, and it's climbing. 3,500 sleep in the streets of D.C. alone. If you see anybody, a cup of coffee, a smile, a prayer, it's the thought at camp. And remember this, it can happen to you. No one is exempt on that tax form. On that tax form, it does not say check for homelessness. You want me to cut it off? Okay. Elmar, you can find me at Walgreens in Chinatown, Connecticut L, from 3 to 6. God bless everybody. And keep it real in America, because everybody needs some help. Hey, young lady, how you doing, baby? Let me get by.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Chantal James on the national broadcast of the Homelessness Marathon, originating from outside the Church of the Epiphany in Northwest Washington, D.C. For this hour, we are discussing mental illness and the homeless, and for this segment, I'm speaking to two more guests who can tell us firsthand what it was like to struggle with mental illness and homelessness. With me are Angie Whitehurst and Sasha Williams, both vendors for Street Sense, the local homeless newspaper, and Brandon Lawrence, an advocate who's